an artist and theoretician. He studied poetry at Emerson College and Columbia University before leaving academia to form a couple indie rock bands, amply documented on the web. The Fire Show and Number One Cup. Seth returned to graduate school to attend London Consortium, where he received his PhD a few years back. He taught art history, art and art history at Pratt and at Yale. And last year became director and assistant professor of art and art theory at the Institute for Doctoral Studies in the Visual Arts. His artwork has been shown at the Tate Modern, at Whitechapel Gallery, and at the ICA in London, ZKM in Karlsruhe, PS 122 here in New York, Firehouse 12, and Grand Projects in New Haven and elsewhere. Seth's critical essays have been published in Art Forum and Art Review. He's the editor of a collection of interviews titled One Reason to Live, came out a few years back, and the author of the fairly recently released, last year, In the Blink of an Ear, Toward a Non-Cochlear Sound Art. He's currently curating an exhibition of non-cochlear sonic art for Babs on Gallery here in Brooklyn. Both of us have kind of bemoaned the lack of a theoretical resources are critical resources beyond the merely descriptive or phenomenological or something. On the other hand, you know, I had a lot of misgivings about the book and about Seth's arguments there. Some of these came out after Seth wrote a review, I guess it was a critical essay really, on a Doug Aitken project in the Brazilian rainforest called Sonic Pavilion, which we'll show you some of in a second. But wrote a review of it. It was very critical of the project. When I read that piece, I noticed a number of the kind of theoretical and critical moves that Seth were making that I also found in his book. So I wrote a long letter to the editor in our forum where I kind of offered a kind of critique of Seth's manner of proposing this. And that kind of started up this conversation again in print, which we thought might be important, at least if we're interested. I think our mutual interest is in kind of trying to help to develop some theoretical discourse on sound. If that's our project, then it might be good to kind of present these, see, air these differences or whatever, see where they get us, also engage some of you folks too, who might have kind of interesting and important sort of inways into thinking about sound in a kind of theoretical, philosophical, critical way. So that's the sort of context for this talk. So.
Yeah, so I'm going to start by showing some images of this Doug Aitken piece and maybe trying to rehearse quickly what I said about it in art form. And Christoph will then kind of respond to that, and we're going to try to, you know, get a little bit of a conversation going in that way. But we also want to make sure we include you guys. So periodically, when we think we've sort of said our piece or whatever, we'll ask anybody who has any questions or comments. So.
And on that note, I wonder whether we might bring up the lights, as it were, just a little bit, just so we can, because we can, we see dark for the most part. So, yeah, go ahead.
So now we can see better.
Oh yeah. So Doug Aitken, who I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, is a pretty prominent artist, and I have to start out by saying that I'm pretty okay with most of his work. I like a lot of the film work that he's done, the thing he did on MoMA a couple years ago. Find all that, but I found this piece very different from any of that stuff. So, I don't want to come off as delivering an ad hominem attack on Doug Aitken person or artist. That's not what this is about. It's really about this particular project and how it relates to sound. So I'll try to kind of give my argument about it succinctly if I can manage to do that. So. To describe the piece, first of all, it's at a place called Inhotim in Brumadinho, Brazil, which is kind of in the middle of the Brazilian jungle, not really very close to any of the major cities. The closest city is Minas Gerais, which is not all that close, actually, and not all that big as Brazilian cities go. And this facility is this amazing place that this Brazilian mining magnate named Bernardo Paz has built in the jungle. He made zillions of dollars, and he decided to just populate this landscape with artwork. So he's brought in, the absolute superstars of the art world and given them untold sums of money to create custom, projects on the site. And there's tons of them, and it's like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory for art. It's just insane, this place. It's manicured gardens with, the first layer of grass is cut at 6 inches, and the second layer of grass is at 8 inches, and it's a slightly darker green, and it's just for acres and acres and acres, it's insane. But this is part of a new series of projects that they've commissioned. Chris Burton has a piece.
Matthew Barney,
Chris. Big names. And Doug has a piece as well. So this is his piece called Sonic Pavilion. As you can see, it's this circular glass pavilion at the top of a hill in the middle of the jungle. In the center of the pavilion, there's a concrete floor, and in the center of the floor, there's a circle cut, and there's a hole that goes roughly a mile deep into the earth. And it's only about, 18 inches in diameter. So it's a very narrow, very deep hole. And he's dropped a series of microphones and other kinds of detectors into the hole at varying heights and amplifies the sounds that are in that hole up into the pavilion. Some collection photos. And I guess that was pretty close to completion. It's not quite done there, but it's pretty close. So you approach the thing from below, you come up this hill, you walk up this path that circles around the hill and then comes up into the pavilion. So the circle starts outside the pavilion and then enters the pavilion and then is mirrored inside the pavilion. You can probably see it there with a sloping walkway that leads up out of a tunnel and then up to sort of a raised platform inside the pavilion. Hopefully you can sort of see that. And then you go inside the pavilion and there's nothing there except this beautiful vista of the Brazilian rainforest and the sounds coming from the hall. So the first way that one might sort of encounter this piece would be to just try to appreciate the sound as sound, you know, to just hear what you're hearing and dig it or not, you know. Do you like what you're hearing? Does it sound good to you? Is the timbre, you know, engrossing in some way? I'm not sure that that's what the piece is really about, but if it were, I wouldn't be satisfied with that. I don't think that sound out of context, sound simply for itself, can be interesting. And I'm sure this is the first place where Christoph's going to have a disagreement. But for me, sound is always a matter of, like anything else, sound is not special in this way, but like anything else, it's a matter of context. It's a matter of how it interacts with other constructs in its vicinity. And its vicinity can be geographical or ideological or philosophical or whatever. But that's how something becomes interesting for me. So I wasn't really interested in just hearing the sound and sort of digging it. So that wasn't going to be the way I was going to engage with it. But then, so if I'm going to look for the context, if I'm going to try to find a way to make this, for this sound to be interesting to me, it's got to be a matter of that context. So the context here for me was this notion of dropping these microphones into the earth and then bringing us the sounds of the earth. So Aitken, I spent the better part of the day that I was there with him, and he was telling me things like that the piece translates, that was his word, translates the earth's movement. And he said, quote, revealing its mysterious and living dialogue. So in other words, the earth has a meaning, and its sound, or at least the sound that Aitken is sort of giving us, is a way to know the meaning of the earth. That seemed to be the implication, at least the implication as I understood it. And I have big problems with that, which I go into at length in the article. This idea that somehow hearing the earth will give us some greater knowledge, some greater understanding of it, you know, whatever even it means. Even if you overlook the fact that Aitken had to transpose these sounds, which are below the frequency of human hearing, and, you know, and make some arbitrary choices to bring it into the range of human hearing so that we could sit in the pavilion and listen to it, even overlooking that mediation on Aitken's part, I don't trust the notion that that the earth has some meaning to reveal to us if only we had greater sensory exposure to it. So that's kind of my second objection. My third objection is a little meta. So it's really about the fact or the problem, in my opinion, that artists do this a lot, that they turn to sound when they want some exposure or some contact with the real. You know, somehow, and I totally don't understand this, maybe Christoph can help us understand it. Somehow sound is more real to a lot of people than other stimuli, other, visual or, olfactory sensations. Somehow sound, I don't know if the notion is that sound can't be manipulated as easily, that sound, because it's a physical phenomenon, so the vibrating source of the sound causes air to move in waves, which then contact our eardrums, so there's an actual kind of physical, indexical connection to the source of the sound. Maybe that makes it more real somehow in the way that certain people think about it. So I was, at this meta level, I was kind of disappointed by the fact that Aitken, an artist who works in other media for the most part, turned to sound in this pristine environment to try to give us this access to the earth, you know. So that was sort of a third issue. And it seemed to me, I'm almost finished, it seemed to me that the whole setup of Sonic Pavilion was intended to create a kind of spiritual, might be one way to think of it, or rarefied kind of sensory experience. You know, you walk up this path. touch with something and feeling, which, you know, I just don't buy. So, so in a nutshell, that was kind of my argument.
Yeah, so let's see, where to begin. There are a number of, one of the things, and we won't stay here, but this is kind of just a starting point, but lots of things here. So one of the things is a kind of philosophical objection to Seth, and I think this is the reason for a lot of people's misgivings about sound, right? It's what Seth calls a sonic essentialism. That is, people tend to treat sound as something in itself, as getting access to the real. And anybody who's spent any amount of time, you know, over the past 30, 40 years, you know, reading post-structuralism, reading deconstruction, reading psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic literature, knows that you just can't say stuff like that, right? You just, Seth can say that, but you any kind of access to the real is suspect. Took me a long time to come around to this, but I'm now fully on board with, you know, calling myself a sonic and every other kind of realist. I think there's no other way to be, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. But my worry is that what Seth, and I think, the thing that I think is important about Seth's argument is that it points to larger arguments and problems with sound in cultural discourse generally, is that there comes to be this distinction between a whole lot of distinctions, but they're similar between, on the one hand, being and meaning, right? Things that are and things that mean. Between nature and culture. Nature is inert, it's dumb, it has no meaning. Culture is what gives it meaning. Culture is what lends it whatever meaning it has. I think there's hugely problematic. For me, what I describe that theoretical sort of matrix as Kantian generally, right? Kant distinguished between phenomena, that is those things that fall within the domain of our experience and that can be meaningful for us, and noumena, that is those things that the world as it must be out there, but to which we can have no access, right? And Kant, there are a whole bunch of reasons why this is the case. I won't run through Kant's, you know, several hundred page argument, but the idea is that somehow or other something must be out there prompting the representations we have. But those representations are mediated by our cognitive and perhaps by extension cultural apparatus, and so we can't have any access to those things in themselves. Now, I'd hardly be the first person to point out the difficulties with that proposal, but one of the difficulties is that it points to the existence of something it claims we can have no knowledge of, right? So on the one hand, it claims awareness of that which we have no knowledge of. And I think that what, with regard to the Aiken piece, one of Seth's problems with it, and I think a problem that a lot of people have with sound, is that there's something there, there's some sonic stuff, but Seth doesn't think it's interesting or important, or it doesn't have a context, and so it lacks any kind of cultural signification. It seems to me that the proper way to deal with that Kantian problem is to eliminate the division between phenomena and noumena. You can do this in two ways. Hegel did it by saying, why don't we just drop out the idea that there's a world in itself at all, and let's just stick with the idea that there are purely, that there are ideas, right? So that way of solving the problem is an idealist solution, okay? It's to say that all there are ideas, all there are representations, and there simply is nothing else, right? We can't demonstrate that there is, let's just get rid of it. And the other way, which is the way that I endorse, which comes from a different philosophical lineage, runs through Spinoza, Nietzsche, Deleuze, whatever, is to say, let's just drop the idea that there are ideas at all. Let's just say that bodies, that this stuff that we are, is exactly the same as the stuff that is, right? Sound, bodies, minds, whatever. It's all the same kind of stuff. And so then you don't have this problem translating across this divide. I'll stop in a moment, but I'll pick this up in a second, hopefully later on. But I think one of the interesting things about sound and why it's important to me is that it challenges challenges the dominant models of cultural, or I shouldn't say sound, I should say sound art practices as they've emerged over the last 40 years. It challenges the dominant kind of modes of cultural thinking about art, which have been theories of representation and theories of signification, and instead asks us to think of culture very differently, asks us to think of culture as a matter of forces, as a matter of flows, as a matter of actions rather than of representations. We can talk more about that later on.
Yeah, so let me pose a couple of questions to you. So, well, first let me defend myself against the Kantian critique, if I can use that word, reversed that way. So I think there's another way to think about the divide that you're talking about, which isn't a matter of noumena preceding phenomena, but of phenomena and then what happens to them or with them. So it's kind of a problem of, you know, where things get interesting is not pre-phenomenal, but post-phenomenal. So it's in the moments when phenomena start to interact in various ways. And whether these phenomena are natural phenomena, cultural phenomena, you know, however they come into being, it's when they start to interact that I become interested. So the noumenal accusation that just doesn't stick, and I don't see it. But anyway, but let me ask you this thing about your material. So I'm really curious about this. So I don't have any objection, and it doesn't strike me as wrong in any way to say that the material of the universe is energy, and to say that ideas are energy, just the same as, you know, rocks are energy, sound is energy, just the same as water is energy. Photosynthesis is a process of energy transformation, the same way that reading is a process of energy transformation. I can deal with all of that, but I can't stop there. That's where I want to hear. I'd like to hear you tell me, like, how does that materialist viewpoint turn into something like a politics, or a theory of social justice, or any kind of position that can make determinations about action? That's where I have a problem with.
Yeah, that's a really long story. I mean, we're, you know, and I don't want to say, you know, one response to that is, come on, man, we're just dealing with sound. Don't talk to me about politics. But I think the one can go from there to there. I want to say something slightly different, or maybe it's to repeat what I said before. But one of the things, I think that discourses of representation and signification, right, which make that distinction between there's a something out there, and then there's a some, and then there's a way it means, right. Discourses of signification and representation have this kind of two-tiered structure, right? Language has that two-tiered structure. There's a signifying substance, and then there's either a referent or a signified to which it refers. Theories of visuality have that same thing too. Here's an image, and it's an image of. Now I realize that this is, you know, unsophisticated stuff, but at least sound, or music, let's say, let's stick with music for, eludes that kind of, doesn't have that kind of two-tiered structure of reference, never have, always has, such that people have always responded. The trouble with music is that, that people have always had with music is either abstract, the common claim is that thinking about music as such is purely formal, purely abstract. Right, and so you get when you get musical theorists, you'll get musical theorists like, you know, for example, Descartes, right, will say music, or Schopenhauer, music is it's sub representational, it's pure emotion, right. Then you get someone like Leibniz who says it's super representational, it's all number, right. But whatever it is, it's not representational because it doesn't refer. So how does this respond to the claim? I think I think sound attunes us to a certain kind of ontology, to an ontology of becoming, image doesn't, or at least, it's not to say that image doesn't, but image tends not to, right? This is what, and that text tends not to. Now, don't get me wrong, my claim is not that sound is some special category, but rather that thinking about sound can open up a way for us to think text and image differently, so that we don't ask of an image, what does it mean, but rather, what does it do? We don't ask of even words, language, as what does it represent, what does it mean, but how does it act, what are its forces? So that's the way. So when it comes back to, I remember we were walking in Berlin once and we were having this conversation about interpretation, and I said something to that I think Seth clearly thought was ludicrous, so much so that he, well, I'll tell you more about it in a second. We were talking about interpretation, and I said, well, trees interpret. He's like, no fucking way do trees interpret, or if you believe that, then we're way further apart than I thought we were, right? But I mean that literally, right? Trees contract, they contract nitrogen from the soil, they contract, sun from the sky, right? In other words, they've drawn all sorts of stuff. That's, you can call that contemplation, you can call that interpretation, Nietzsche has this famous account of interpretation. It's very much like that. It's all about, what's the model of interpretation for Nietzsche? It's digestion, right? Like, in other words, right? Human beings throw stuff in their mouths, the body takes stuff in, it uses what it can, spits the rest out. It's really, when we read a text, we do the exact same thing, right? So to think about interpretation, to think about apprehension on that model, that's the right way to think about what it is to read a text, rather than what does it represent, what does it mean, right? I don't know if that's a long-winded answer, but I don't know if that goes somewhere.
Can you say something about the Aiken piece? I mean, sure. So
I haven't had the luck to go to Brazil. Seth's no doubt the only person in this room who has. We can pretty much say whatever the hell he wants about it. And we'll all know that, yeah, that's definitely true.
I think you're
right. No. I don't mean to say that he's a misrepresentation. One thing I should say, and this is interesting, actually. I don't know if it's a criticism of Aiken, but it's interesting. When I asked Aiken's studio, I said, can you supply us with some images? They said, yeah, no trouble. And they gave Seth a bunch earlier, and I said,
by the way, we invited Doug Aiken to come to this and be the third member of the conversation. He wasn't interested. So.
He had read Seth's piece. He had also read mine.
But I would have been genuinely interested in having him here. I mean,
decided
it and to let him speak his mind, I think, would be absolutely welcome.
Yeah. But so asked for sound samples, the studio said, no, we don't have any of that. Now, that seems like a wrong word, but an oversight, right? Like, I mean, it seems like, seriously, I mean, if it's a sonic pavilion, there's something missing here, right? So, supply an endless number of images. And in Seth's conversations with him, Seth was talking to Aiken, sorry, I'm representing you, but about the history of sound art, much of which was, he seems sort of not to know much about. That's so, I mean, artists know what they know, whatever, but it's interesting. It's just to say, what I mean to say is, you don't need to do this kind of work with that history in mind, but it's kind of interesting that history wasn't in mind, right? So you treat it treats the sonic in a different way. Where was I going with that? Right, about the sound, right, okay, so I haven't heard the piece, but it seems to me a totally fascinating and interesting, if ridiculously expensive and overwrought, project. Surely the Earth sounds like something. I know it does. I mean, I'm sure it does, right? The Earth is a totally dynamic system, a dynamic geological system. No doubt that makes sounds. To me, the fact that this stuff we stand on, this stuff we walk on, is this kind of mobile, fluid enterprise that undergoes changes, and that those changes can be made automatically. it's not so different from any, you know, the ordinary piece of experimental music, for example. Sets up a context and then lets the thing run, lets the thing go. Seems that there's a fair amount of authorial giving over to the earth to do whatever it's going to do. No?
Is it slow? Is it
slow?
Some of it is, but not all of it. So you hear, you know, there is kind of a fairly regular and constant kind of low rumble, and then there's events, you know, little cracklings and creakings that you hear as well, that are higher pitch. So there's a pretty wide range of frequencies. But he doesn't tell you what the transpositions are, so you don't know if the low thing. So I asked him this outright. I said, so are you keeping the ratios consistent? So if you're transposing, you know, the lowest tone you're getting, the lowest frequencies you're getting, if you're, you know, transposing them at a certain ratio, are you also transposing other frequencies that you're getting at the same ratio? So we're hearing those harmonic, if that's not misstating it, harmonic relations as they exist in the earth. And he didn't answer, like refused to answer. And I wasn't clear if he didn't know the answer, because he has a lot of technicians working with him, and I don't know if he knew the answer. So it wasn't clear to me if he knew the answer or just didn't want to tell.
What's weird about that question for me is that if there's any kind of essentialism somewhere, it's like, give me the goddamn earth as it really sounds. Don't do this transposition. And there's the word about this transposition. Again, my claim about interpretation, contemplation, call it what you will, Deleuze draws the notion of contemplation from Plotinus, who says famously in the Enneads, he says, the plants contemplate, you know, the flower contemplates. All he means by contemplation is like, draw shit in and make use of it, right? And that's like, this is exactly that. In other words, it's a kind of rendering, and it's a rendering of the thing itself in some way. It's a rendering it in a way that can make it audible, can make it useful. It's surely the thing, and it's not the thing, right? It's the transposition, whatever. But you get a clearer sense of whatever the hell the earth sounds like, I'm sure, I've been there, than we would sitting here imagining it, no?
To be clear, I didn't care what the answer to that ratio question was, but I was curious to hear what he would say about it, how he would respond to the question. And the fact that he was evasive, you know, said something to me. So, you know, I would ask the question of this piece, what if someone were to put in the pavilion, what if Aiken chose to put in the pavilion, yeah, right in there, a little plaque of some kind or a little kiosk that gave you the information that said, here's the dimensions of the hole, here's how deep all the microphones are, here's what kinds of microphones they are, here are the transpositions I'm doing, here's what you're hearing, at this level it's plate tectonic shifting, but at this level it's stone rubbing against stone, and at this level it's gravel tumbling down through crevice. I don't know what it is, but what if he gave you all that information, then what?
That's partly the difference between art and science, right? I mean, science gives you all that information and says this is precisely what you're hearing, and the art says, just, you know what? Don't listen to this as an index of something. Just listen to it as a set of sounds. That's interesting in and of itself. Again, think about somebody like Alvin Lussier, right? Whose very, very basic sound projects often that have a kind of real rootedness often in physics. And you could say about Lussier, you know, why aren't you just doing, you know, high school science experiments, which on some level he is. But then you say, they're high school science experiments that are brought into a context that says, forget about empirical descriptions and what they refer to, what they mean. Listen to the thing as a set of sounds, see if you find them interesting, and see if you find the set of processes that generate them to be productive, valuable, etc.
But in the case of Lussier, if you read the scores, it's essentially the answer to the question set of that.
No.
Your typical Lussier score says, and there's poetry involved too, it's not just the science part.
Take something really basic, right? So take the music on the long thin wire. Right. He says, this is what I did. I mean, you know, anybody who's ever heard Lussier speak is the most dead man guy in the world. He'll give you like the least possible information, not because he's cagey, but just because he's taciturn or something. But he'll say, this is what I did. I put a clamp here, I put a wire here, I set it up, and then stuff happened. That's really the end, and that's pretty much the score, no?
The score for something like Vespers, where it's an instruction not only for something that you can do or something that he has done, but also
some of us.
Well, I, me too, but it could be unhinged from its source, and then it's talking about much more of that portable phenomenon. You know, like, what is the importance of this hole in the ground? We're just supposed to appreciate its sound.
I mean, I have to say that I don't understand the import of the question, because I think that if it's just sounds, like, that part of it just...
Let's get some other perspective and see if that helps.
So the question was, do I object that there's no proof that it is in fact the sound of the earth? No, I don't care if it's the sound of the earth.
This is the thing itself, right? And that is something that cultural discourse that historical discourse, you know, the theoretical discourses I sort of rattled off to begin with, had been deeply suspicious about it. And one of the important things about sound art for me is that I think sound art begins to challenge or unravel that set of presuppositions. Yep.
Thank you.
similarities to the kind of thing that Christina Kubisch, German sound artist, uses with her electromagnetic headphones that she sort of gives out at galleries to do these electric walks that pick up various sort of signals. And so I'm curious whether you, Seth, have some similar issues with this kind of work that you have with the